Americans who travel abroad are often stunned by the size of their mobile phone bills. Even if they aren't actively using the phone, they can rack up hundreds and sometimes thousands of dollars in charges. NPR's Wendy Kaufman explains why that happens and what you can do about it if you travel.
Los Angeles resident Lisa French thought she was being very careful when she took her smartphone on a trip to Japan.
I was advised not to make any phone calls, as phone calls overseas are very, very expensive.
So is text messaging, so she wasn't planning to do that either. She took note of an alert that popped up on her phone shortly after arriving in Japan, warning about possible data charges, but she wasn't planning to spend a lot of time online. And she says,
since I had traveled to Germany and Barcelona in the past, and I really only got maybe $30 or $40 more on my phone bill, I thought, oh, okay, it's only going to be about that much.
French was in for a big surprise. A few days into her trip, she checked her account online.
I found at the very bottom, very hard to read, that I had $462 in roaming charges. It was like a slap in the face.
Smartphones try to connect to the internet using Wi-Fi. It's often free, so you don't incur connection charges. But if the device doesn't pick up Wi-Fi, it will use a cellular network. And what runs up the bill is usually data. Mike Gikas, a senior editor at Consumer Reports, explains that even when you don't think you're using the phone, the device is running in the background, doing things like retrieving email, updating apps, and tracking your location.
And all of these things that happen nonchalantly on your phone, suddenly you'll be paying $5, $10, $15 a megabyte, which you can burn through in no time.
For example, location-based restaurant reviews, even ones you don't specifically ask for, could cost $2 or $3 each, and you might get half a dozen or more of them in a single day.
The trick for consumers is to be informed.
That's William Friedman, an official at the Federal Communications Commission. In 2010, the FCC proposed rules to get wireless carriers to provide timely and effective notice to consumers about these charges. The cell phone companies countered with a voluntary standard, and the federal government said okay.
Significantly, they agreed that these alerts would be provided free of charge, and there was no opt-in.
While some wireless carriers are already providing consumers with some notifications, carriers don't have to fully comply with the industry standard until next spring. But travelers don't have to wait. There are a number of steps you can take right now. One solution is to simply buy a prepaid local phone once you reach your destination. But if you can't part with your smartphone, John Walls of CTIA, the industry trade group, says you can turn off your phone's roaming function.
So that the only time that phone will work in a data capacity is in a Wi-Fi area that won't cost you.
You can also turn the device off completely and turn it on only if you know you're inside a Wi-Fi hotspot. You can also purchase a prepaid data plan. In short, says Walls, consumers have choices.
But you do have to be proactive and, in this case, go get it.
He urges travelers to call their wireless carrier's customer service line and check the provider's website before they leave home. Wendy Kaufman, NPR News.
In his State of the Union speech, President Obama promised to increase development of natural gas. One technique to get that gas from underground rock has drawn plenty of criticism. Hydraulic fracturing uses fluid to push up the gas, something that concerns environmentalists. Whatever its drawbacks, it's becoming clear that fracking, as it's called, is producing a lot of natural gas. As NPR's Christopher Joyce reports, maybe too much.
Fracking was once a small part of the natural gas industry, a technique to get hard-to-reach deposits in underground shale. Then the technology improved, and the dinner bell rang. Everybody wanted in. Now there's so much gas on the market that the price is at a 10-year low. Michael Keyes is a vice president of Chesapeake Energy, one of the biggest shale gas producers.
A boom has only occurred over the last few years, and the market at first wasn't sure that it was real. But it is so real that it's actually depressing prices, and the view is that the price is going to remain low for a number of years going forward.
In fact, companies are storing a lot of gas instead of selling it. And now Chesapeake is pulling back from some wells. The company is moving half its drilling rigs from wells that produce dry gas. the stuff you use in your stove or water heater. Instead, they'll drill in places where there's also wet gas, stuff like ethylene, propylene, and butadiene. These are mostly used to make plastic or textiles, and they bring a higher price. Some of these wells also produce oil, also pricey right now. Economist Sarah Banaszak of the trade group America's Natural Gas Alliance says other energy companies are doing the same, but they aren't likely to abandon shale gas.
Companies that are here to produce natural gas are here for the long term. You know, there are, you know, micro adjustments in the path along the way, but I think they've made their investments and they're going to pursue that path.
Banaszak says fracking operations are pretty flexible.
One thing that is good about a lot of the unconventional production is the ability to sort of scale it up and down with changes in demand and supply.
For Chesapeake's Michael Keyes, it's a matter of waiting for more people, electric utilities or factories, to move to gas power.
You know, it's almost like the shale field of dreams. You know, we've built it, and now the demand will come.
A warm winter has also kept prices down, but analysts at the Federal Energy Information Agency say low prices could last for years, which could boost demand eventually. If it doesn't, there's already talk in the industry about liquefying America's surplus gas and exporting it overseas. Christopher Joyce, NPR News.
They didn't have many big hits, and in the beginning, when it would have made a difference, they didn't even make videos. In the 1980s, when post-punk extravagance was the name of the game, they dared to call themselves the Smiths, as if to pretend they were just an ordinary bunch of guys. And yet they were one of the defining groups of their era. With the release of their complete works, rock historian Ed Ward has the occasion to look back and try and figure out what made them so important.
Call me morbid, call me pale. I've spent 6 years on your trail. 6 long years on your trail. Call me morbid, call me pale. I've spent 6 years on your trail. 6 full years of my life on your trail. And if you have 5 seconds to spare, then I'll tell you the story of my life. 16, clumsy and shy, I went to London and died. I booked myself in at the Y, WCA. I said, I like it here, can I stay? I like it here, can I stay? Do you have a vacancy for a back scrubber?
When Stephen Patrick Morrissey was 13, he was watching the Old Grey Whistle Test, a BBC rock television show, when the New York Dolls came on. Later he said that it was my first real emotional experience. It was hardly his last. Growing up awkward, tall, and shy in suburban Manchester, he was the archetypal kid who didn't fit in, writing poetry and letters to the British rock press, disagreeing articulately with their critics. Years before, Manchester had lost out to Liverpool as Britain's provincial rock capital, but with the arrival of punk, it snatched the crown back. Morrissey joined a punk band called the Nosebleeds briefly, but he had other ideas. In May 1982, he read that a writer for Record Mirror named Johnny Marr, a guitarist who'd been in a couple of bands, was looking for a lyricist. The two met and hit it off immediately. And a year later, they'd put together a band, had a couple of gigs, been signed to London's Rough Trade Records, and started releasing singles. It took a couple of them, but they eventually had a hit of sorts.
All men have secrets and here is mine, so let it be known. For we have been through hell and high tide. I think I can rely on you. And yet you start to recoil. Heavy words are so lightly thrown, but still I leap in front. Flying bullet for you. So what difference does it make?
This wasn't pop music as we knew it by any means, although a superficially similar band, R.E.M., was operating in the United States, an odd vocalist matched with a guitarist who could seemingly do anything. Unlike Michael Stipe, though, Morrissey didn't cloak his lyrics in ambiguity.
The rain falls hard on a humdrum town. This town has
dragged you down. Oh, the rain falls hard on a humdrum town. This town has dragged you down. Everybody's got to live their life, and God knows I've got to live mine. God knows I've got to live mine. William, William, it was.
Morrissey claimed to be celibate, although the British pop press was skeptical. The slowly increasing number of fans didn't care, though. Some of them were drawn to the confessional songwriting, some to the guitar sounds. For instance, on the B-side of William It Was Really Nothing was this gem.
I'm the sun and the air. All the shyness that is criminally broken. Sun and air, but nothing in particular. You shut your mouth, how can you say? I go about things the wrong way. I am human and I need to be loved, just like everybody else.
The Smiths were also lucky to have a rhythm section like bassist Andy Rourke and drummer Mike Joyce, who seemed to navigate the odd twists and turns of Johnny Marr's melodies with ease. The Smiths were also masters of marketing. Each of their singles and albums had, on the cover, an icon of filmdom, his or her photograph, manipulated by Morrissey and Rough Trade's art director Joe Slee. Terrence Stamp, Elvis Presley, Shelagh Delaney, and James Dean were among the cover boys and girls who gave a new Smiths release a distinctive look. And it was a good thing that there was a distinctive look, because after their second album, Meat Is Murder, took aim at some social issues, it became clear that Marr's melodies were pretty similar and that Morrissey's great subject was himself, take it or leave it. What happened next was complicated. The band slowly gained momentum with the fans, at least in Britain. Their third album, The Queen Is Dead, is probably the high point of the band's career, released in June 1986 after a long and unexplained delay.
Take me out tonight, where there's music and there's people and the young and the light. Driving in your car, I haven't got one anymore. Take me out.
By 1987, the band was big enough that it had to sign with EMI in order to meet the demand for its records, and immediately everything fell apart. Johnny Marr had been working nonstop, both with the Smiths and with other bands, and he realized he was about to have a breakdown. He quit the band, and within a few months, the Smiths were no more. Well, that's not strictly true. Their cult was growing in America, and it was rampant in Britain. They'd released a lot of singles and B-sides, which hadn't shown up on albums, and their record company set about repackaging them. And they've influenced pop culture disproportionately. Smith's phrases turn up everywhere, from the Meat Is Murder meme to Douglas Copeland's novel Girlfriend in a Coma, which is a Smith song, to a poster for a club event this past weekend, which I saw emblazoned with the words Hang the DJ. The Smiths are dead. Long live the Smiths.
Ed Ward lives in France. He reviewed the Smiths' complete collection, now repackaged for CD and vinyl. Coming up, David Bean Cooley reviews the new Kiefer Sutherland drama, Touch. This is Fresh Air.
More than 6 years after Hurricane Katrina, thousands of blighted properties dot the landscape in New Orleans. A group of artists has taken one property and transformed it into something surprising, a structure that makes music. Kathleen Osborne paid a visit.
It's called the Music Box. In fact, it's a small village of ramshackle sculptures huddled together on Piety Street in the Bywater section of the once-flooded Ninth Ward. They're outfitted as musical instruments and made almost entirely of the remains from the 18th-century Creole cottage that used to sit on this lot. Curator Delaney Martin points to a rotating organ speaker on top of half an A-frame shack called the Heartbeat House.
A stethoscope plays your heartbeat through a spinning Leslie speaker. And it spins round and round, and, you know, unlike a church bell calls people to congregation or an alarm, what we want to have is a heartbeat, this primal beat that calls to the people of New Orleans and says, come out and dance, come out and sing, come out and have fun.
Local and national artists were invited to dream up the instruments and structures that inhabit the lot. Taylor Lee Shepard is a mechanical sculptor who moved to the city after Hurricane Katrina. He's built a singing wall that samples and plays back the voices that fill the home.
Just start recording people as they come through, little kids and anybody that seems interested or curious. And it'll just change all throughout the day, and I have all these different textures and rhythms all mixed together. It sums up a moment in time.
These structures are an experimental first step towards building a fully functional musical house that will be the headquarters and residency space for the New Orleans Airlift. The organization was created after Katrina to raise the profile of local artists, often through collaborations with more famous creators. New York-based street artist Callie Curry, known as Swoon, designed the house for Airlift.
I hope it represents this very basic need in people while rebuilding, to rebuild joyfully and with imagination.
Transforming that hope into reality by bringing in outsiders is a touchy subject in the city, says Music Box associate curator Theo Elizer, who grew up in New Orleans.
There's a lot of resentment that existed over the past 6 years of people coming to New Orleans to contribute in a way that was about fixing New Orleans, and there were legitimate things that needed to be fixed, like houses that were flooded. But culturally, we didn't need to be fixed, and our communities didn't need to be fixed.
Everyone involved in the project is keenly aware of striking the right balance in a city where Hurricane Katrina turned long-term homeowners into renters. Jay Pennington is Airlift's co-director.
There is a natural antipathy in this neighborhood to seeing anyone do anything with a house that's not going to put somebody in it to live. And it's something that people are really sensitive about here.
As the city continues the long process of rebuilding, Pennington and Delaney Martin hope the final house will be an example of the beauty that can emerge from all of that destruction.
I, amongst many of my other artist friends, can look at an old falling down house and see a great deal of beauty, see a great deal of salvageable materials, and see a great deal of inspiration. What I don't want to see, as much as I want blight to be resolved, I would hate to see all these beautiful old properties bulldozed and thrown away and new developments put in. That's not our neighborhood anymore if we do that. So this was our answer to it. And I think what was important to us to create out of this blight is a sense of wonder and possibility. We have 30 school children in the yard right now, so I'm going to go attend to them. You're welcome to join.
15-year-old D'Angelo Falk, who came with a group of students from the New Orleans Center for Creative Arts, tried out the musical rocking chair.
What do you think?
It's so cool.
I think this is the most best music I have ever made on my own. Very artistic. I never seen something like this, and I live in the neighborhood.
And that's the point, says Delaney Martin.
Right across the way there, across this big street on the other bad side of the tracks, there is this utter lack of wonder and possibility. There's a lot of closed doors. There's not many options. And what I hope that, you know, can happen is that they can come here to the Music Box, which is really like a Peter Pan wonderland, and remember this blighted house and now see this sort of resurrected, amazing thing, and that does have value, because when you don't have options and you see something that totally is from another world, that is about expanding your imagination and your options. And I think that there's true value in that.
As one neighbor put it, the Music Box also brings something else to their community, hope. For NPR News, I'm Kathleen Osborne.
You're listening to All Things Considered from NPR News. Heart disease is the leading cause of death in the U.S., and now a new study offers a simple method for predicting the risk of having a heart attack or stroke. It comes from the New England Journal of Medicine, and NPR's Patty Naimond tells us more.
As it is now, doctors talk to middle-aged patients about the risk of having a heart attack or stroke over the next 5 to 10 years. That typically means a 4% chance of having a cardiovascular event, even if patients have high blood pressure or cholesterol. When you look at the rest of someone's life, say the next 20 or 30 years, the risk changes dramatically. Cardiologist Donald Lloyd-Jones headed the study at Northwestern University Feinberg School of Medicine.
If at age 45 you have two or more of either elevated blood pressure, elevated cholesterol, diabetes, or smoking, and you're a man, then there's basically a 50-50 proposition that you will have a heart attack or a stroke during your remaining lifespan.
To figure that out, Lloyd-Jones tallied the results of 18 different long-term studies over the past 50 years involving men, women, African-Americans, and whites, more than 250,000 adults. He looked at risk factors for heart disease like high blood pressure, high cholesterol, diabetes, or smoking. Then he compared that to who died or suffered disability from a heart attack or stroke. Lloyd-Jones found both African-American and white men who had at least two risk factors had a 50% chance of suffering a major cardiovascular event, while women had a 30% chance. Having even one risk factor dramatically increased the risk of heart disease.
Currently, only 5% of Americans make it into middle age, by which I mean ages of 45 to 55 years, without already having elevated blood pressure or elevated cholesterol or diabetes or being a smoker.
That means 95% of middle-aged Americans have at least one risk factor for heart disease. Nonetheless, there is some good news here. Actually, great news, says Lloyd-Jones. Non-smokers who can make it to middle age with normal levels of blood pressure, cholesterol, and blood sugars bring their risk of heart disease down to nearly zero.
Our data suggested that for a 45-year-old man, the likelihood he would have a heart attack or stroke by age 80 was only 1.4%.
The goal, says Lloyd-Jones, help more Americans make it to middle age without any risk factors for heart disease. That means tracking their blood pressure, cholesterol, and blood sugar early in adulthood. Cardiologist Gordon Tomaselli is president of the American Heart Association. He says young adults should measure their blood pressure even if they don't have a doctor.
There are automated blood pressure cuffs publicly available in many venues, like in grocery stores and in pharmacies, where you can actually go to get your blood pressure measured.
If it's high, says Tomaselli, see a healthcare provider. As for cholesterol,
if you have a family history of high cholesterol, that really should prompt you to get checked earlier on in life.
In your 30s or even 20s, he says. That also goes for diabetes. If there's a family history, blood sugars should be checked early on. Diet, exercise, and medications can be highly effective when people have these health problems. And while they can't wipe out heart disease risk entirely, they can control and manage symptoms pretty well. Patty Naimond, NPR News.
More All Things Considered coming up right after this. This is All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Alyssa Block.
And I'm Robert Siegel. The school taco is getting a makeover. Today, the USDA released new school lunch standards. They trim salt, sugar, and portion sizes to make lunch healthier. First Lady Michelle Obama was on hand at an elementary school in Alexandria, Virginia, for a taste test. NPR's Allison Aubrey has the story.
As the First Lady slid her tray down the lunch line with a bunch of students at Park Lawn Elementary, she scooped up the brown rice turkey tacos, served with fresh salsa on whole grain flatbread.
This is so nice. It's so well prepared.
Oh, I love it.
And she says this is what a meal is supposed to look like. Lots of color, lots of taste, but lighter on fat, calories, and salt. Talking to parents who'd gathered at the school, the First Lady says these new standards, which also mandate 2 servings of veggies per meal, aren't only about combating obesity. They're also about helping kids stay sharp mentally in the classroom, avoiding those mid-afternoon sugar crashes. And hopefully, she says, the standards will help reinforce the messages lots of moms and dads have been trying to drill into kids' heads about good nutrition.
When we send our kids to school, we have a right to expect that they won't be eating the kind of fatty, salty, sugary foods that we're trying to keep from them when they're at home.
More than 32 million kids participate in school meal programs every day. And advocates who've been pushing for healthier meals say this is progress, though the rules are not as aggressive as the Obama administration had hoped for. Margot Wu-Tan directs nutrition efforts at the Center for Science in the Public Interest.
It's a huge step forward. These new school meal standards will mean much healthier foods on our kids' lunch trays.
Even though the trays will continue to carry servings of French fries and pizza, Wu-Tan says the U.S. Department of Agriculture was not able to finalize a provision that would have restricted servings of French fries, nor were they able to cancel out a rule that allows schools to count pizza as a vegetable. On these issues, she says Congress and powerful food lobbyists prevailed.
Under the new standards, even though USDA wasn't able to do what they wanted to do around limiting French fries and not counting pizza as a vegetable anymore, there still will be healthier pizza in the school lunch.
It'll have a whole grain crust, be lower in sodium and fat, and it will need to be served with another vegetable. The USDA estimates that the price tag for new nutrition standards will total about $3.2 billion over the next 5 years, with many of the changes being phased in gradually. But Diane Pratt-Hevner of the School Nutrition Association says school food directors are already trying creative ways to win students over on healthier eating.
We're seeing more schools with salad bars and student taste tests and Harvest of the Month programs that they're really trying to encourage kids to expand their palates and try fruits and vegetables that they might not have encountered at home.
As for mom Alyssa Simmons, who attended the First Lady's announcement today, she says these new lunches, especially the 2 servings of vegetables, will be better than what she usually manages to pack for her son.
We're always so pressed for time. You just throw here and there, you figure one is good enough.
So Simmons says from now on, her son will be eating the school lunch. Allison Aubrey, NPR News.